Today is Wednesday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the psychological effect of social distancing in the age of COVID-19?
Breathe in very slowly, then breathe out. Do it at least 3 times, and you'll notice anxiety will slowly go away.
Plus, how critical is the supply of medical resources?
Really is a dangerous position to be in, because then now we're talking about lives that could potentially be lost.
And a music legend is remembered. Those stories and more are all next. Buckingham Palace says the heir to the British throne, Prince Charles, has tested positive for the coronavirus. Charles de Ledesma with the Associated Press starts us off.
The Prince's Clarence House office says the 71-year-old has COVID-19 and is self-isolating at a royal estate in Scotland. The office adds his wife, Camilla, has tested negative. The palace says Charles has been displaying mild symptoms and otherwise remains in good health and has been working from home throughout the last few days as usual. Charles de Ledesma, London.
China has lifted a lockdown on Hubei province, where the novel coronavirus pandemic began. While the World Health Organization warns that the United States could be the next center of the outbreak. China overall has seen vast declines in its caseload after implementing tough measures to keep people at home and prevent the spreading of the virus. Chinese health officials reported Wednesday 47 new cases, all of them among people who arrived from other countries. COVID-19 has reached nearly every country in the world, infecting some 435,000 people and killing about 19,000, according to Johns Hopkins University figures. Infectious disease physicians and other healthcare professionals on the front lines of combating the COVID-19 outbreak have urged U.S. President Donald Trump to activate the Defense Production Act, or DPA, to mobilize efforts to produce coronavirus testing kits, masks, and ventilators. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, said on Tuesday such a move wasn't needed, that they could procure items without invoking the DPA. Dr. Mahalia Desrosso works with infectious diseases at the Yale University School of Medicine. I spoke with her about the importance of making sure there's enough equipment to care for those with and without the coronavirus.
We don't have the proper equipment to be able to support individuals that have severe disease from SARS-CoV-2. It's really is a dangerous position to be in, because then now we're talking about lives that could potentially be lost. So it is pretty it's pretty imminent that we get the proper equipment, proper protective equipment to protect the healthcare workers, especially those on the front lines, and equipment to keep people alive.
Not only are we talking about SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus that's the worldwide pandemic that it is now, but this is also coming on the heels of just everyday people needing the respirators, needing the ventilators that are being used to treat people with the viruses. Is what government are doing right now in terms of upping production and trying to find other sources, is it too little too late in terms of shoring up healthcare systems?
I mean, there's a lot that could have been done before. We could have been better prepared, but I think that at this point, we have to move forward. We have to look ahead into what potentially could be a huge onslaught of new cases. And you're absolutely right. This is in addition to everyone else who's in critical condition for other reasons, not having anything to do with COVID-19. We have to prepare for the onslaught of new cases of COVID-19 that are going to be coming into the hospitals. And we have not seen the peak of this yet.
If we take a look at production in the United States and elsewhere, there are other countries out there that do not have as robust manufacturing capabilities, but they're still going to be facing the COVID-19 outbreak. What can be done to assist them? Is just shifting resources from one country to another, like South Korea said it is going to send surpluses of equipment to the United States. Is that enough?
I think that there's got to be some sort of global community feeling where places that are doing better can lend a hand to places that don't have the proper resources. So, you know, as you mentioned, South Korea, and I know earlier this week there were physicians from Cuba that traveled to Italy to help with the healthcare workers that, you know, they don't have enough healthcare workers in Italy, and so individuals from Cuba went in to help. And I think that feeling of community should be present, and it shouldn't. I don't really believe that in this situation where there is a pandemic that this is the correct time to put up borders, yes, to contain the virus. But in terms of how we interact with other countries, I think that there has to be better communal, a feeling of community to help our neighbors.
Dr. Mahalia Desrosso is an associate professor at the Yale University School of Medicine. There's agreement in Washington on a massive rescue package to ease the economic damage of COVID-19. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The hard part is done, with congressional leaders and the White House finally reaching agreement on a historic $2 trillion emergency rescue package to stabilize the nation's economy during the coronavirus shutdown. The package includes a direct one-time payment to most Americans of $1,200 per adult and $500 per child. The legislation also includes $367 billion for small businesses, expanded unemployment benefits, and significant help for hospitals. The legislative language still needs to be finalized. Mike Gracia, Washington.
It is hard for many to stay calm while getting the seemingly never-ending updates on the coronavirus situation in the world, as the number of infected people in Europe topped those in China. Maxim Moskalkov talked to psychologists about fighting anxiety and remaining calm during this testing time.
It is hard to keep your distance from the constant TV coverage and worrying charts showing the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. Some people start panicking, anxiety levels rise. According to psychiatrist Mary Alvord, panic is a natural human response to stress.
I think it gets back to, as humans, what do we feel like we need for survival? So water goes, you know, off the shelves, even though there's no water shortage. You know, we don't really need 5 cases of water, and yet the stores are now limiting you to maybe 1 case or 2 cases.
Psychologists add that it is extremely important to be discerning about where you get your news so you can be well informed. And it's also important to control your emotions and avoid panicking.
And maybe even look at this as some opportunities. Is there an opportunity now that you're home more, or you can connect with relatives or friends that you haven't spoken with in a long time? So I think with every crisis, there are opportunities.
Psychologist and scientist Vail Wright says we should not underestimate the power of routine. Schedules and routine help maintain calm and gives the feeling of normalcy many feel they lack.
To prepare yourself mentally, you need to be doing things like engaging in self-care. It's really important to keep routine, to go to bed at the same time every night and wake up in the morning like if it was a regular work day. Don't treat this like a snow day. Still shower, get dressed, eat meals at the same time.
Clinical psychologist Irina Meleksitian adds that the way a person responds to a crisis situation depends a lot on their psychological type.
It will be harder for introverts who already have certain anxieties to live under constant stress. They feel especially isolated because they can't meet with the people they're used to relying upon. But thankfully, we have all this technology. We can call, we have Skype and FaceTime. It helps to keep communicating with loved ones, to show compassion, to demonstrate we care, and to know others care about us.
In more severe cases of panic attacks, psychologists say breathing correctly can help reduce the stress and anxiety levels.
Breathe in very slowly, then breathe out. Do it at least 3 times, and you'll notice anxiety will slowly go away. Try to stay positive. Try to stay calm. This is just something we all need to get through.
Doctors and psychologists emphasize the importance of only reading reputable sources and talking to specialists. Knowledge and facts are the main tactics to fight uncertainty and anxiety, they say. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
And still coming up later in the program.
In this aid is so vital and could have very serious implications for, sustaining the security operations for the government in Afghanistan.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In Colombia, three social leaders have been killed over the past week in the lead-up to the Wednesday start of a nationwide lockdown against COVID-19. Colombian social leaders are prominent activists who fight for human rights, environmental protection, and other causes. But they are often targeted by the country's many armed groups who persist despite the official end to a decades-long civil war in 2016. While social leaders usually stay on the move for safety, traveling with government-provided bodyguards, the coronavirus outbreak makes such precautions difficult. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin heard from Bogota-based journalist Joe Parkin Daniels on the twin threats for Colombia's social leaders of targeted killings and COVID-19.
In the days leading up to the announcement last week of drastic quarantine measures in cities across Colombia, three social leaders were murdered. And when I say social leaders, I'm talking about environmental and human rights activists, usually in rural parts of the country. One was murdered in the very south of the country, on the border with Ecuador. Another on the border with Venezuela, and another in the kind of western highlands. And that suggests that no matter where you are, how isolated or close to cities you are kind of vulnerable to these attacks, which have been going on steadily for 3 years since the peace deal was signed.
Three in basically the span of a week. It seems like quite a lot.
Yes, it is quite a lot. Unfortunately and tragically, it seems that with the focus on coronavirus, which is kind of consuming all the government's efforts and resources, we're seeing essentially less coverage and less protection for people who are vulnerable. And it's important to remember that these social leaders, they have been kind of in the crosshairs of armed groups forever. That hasn't changed. The only difference is, due to the pandemic, armed groups are able to exploit the kind of vacuum of coverage and of monitoring in regions where they operate.
And is there any indication in any of these three cases as to who is responsible?
The indications are that they're what we call post-conflict or post-demobilization groups. Exactly because of who, of which groups, in which cases isn't clear yet. Investigations are still going on. Post-demobilization groups following the demobilization of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, leftist rebel group that demobilized in 2016, and also successor groups to paramilitaries, right-wing paramilitaries, which demobilized 2006-2008. But it is essentially kind of irrelevant what ideology the group claims to have, because these groups on the ground to the social leaders are the same. They are groups fighting over territory to fund ideological kind of war effort, and they fund that with illegal economies like illegal mining, drug trafficking, extortion rackets, people smuggling, arms running, anything.
When you talk about demobilized armed groups, that sounds like these groups aren't really demobilized, that maybe this peace deal, which was signed a few years ago, isn't going as well as many people would have hoped.
That's right. It's not going as well as people might hope. Its implementation is going slowly. It's been kind of undercut from various sides. Some FARC members have and commanders have gone back to the jungle and taken troops with them. The government has also not funded it as it was supposed to. And so the peace deal is shaky. It's still holding, but it's not the kind of great peace riots in the countryside that the people kind of hoped.
Now, getting back to the activists, what about other activists now? What are they doing to keep safe? Like everybody else, they are going to be locking down, staying at home because of the virus. Have you talked to any other activists, and what are they feeling right now, and what are they planning?
They're scared for their safety, for the safety of their communities. both in terms of the threats on their lives and the threat of the pandemic. So they are planning on bunkering down as much as they can. They will still have to move. Social leaders fall under that protection of people that can break quarantine if they need to. And so they'll move around because they move around to stop being detected. But of course, that means risking infecting people or getting infected themselves. And they travel in armored cars and they have bodyguards provided by the state. But it remains to be seen in practice how that will work.
That was Bogota-based journalist Joe Parkin Daniel speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Gunmen stormed into a Sikh Hindu temple in central Kabul Wednesday and were locked into a battle with security forces in the latest assault on the Afghan capital. The attack resulted in the deaths of at least 25 people. I spoke with VOA journalist Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad via WhatsApp to learn more.
Well, what we understand as of this moment that Afghan security forces have been able to end this nearly 6 hours long siege that started early Wednesday morning when a group of four suicide bombers, heavily armed, stormed this Sikh temple and the adjacent community center where there were several dozen families inside the facility. But what we know that the security forces have killed all four assailants.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was just recently in Afghanistan and on his way out of the country. He spoke to reporters and said that they were essentially going to cut U.S. aid. What likely impact may that have on the violent situation in Afghanistan?
Well, this is, he has already announced that, Secretary Pompeo has already announced that the U.S. has already cut $1 billion in assistance and has, vowed to cut another $1 billion next year if this political dispute is not settled. Now, this financial assistance is primarily the one that is being provided to the Afghan government to sustain its security forces, which are heavily reliant on foreign assistance, like around $4 billion the United States has been providing to sustain and improve the ability of Afghan security forces. So one can imagine that any cut in this aid is so vital and could have very serious implications for, sustaining the security operations for the government in Afghanistan against the Taliban insurgents and against groups like Islamic State. So that has very serious consequences for the security situation in Afghanistan, because we know that there have been complaints by Afghan security forces for not receiving salaries in time and, complaining about other lack of fundings because obviously, corruption at the top leadership in Afghan security forces have prevented the benefits of this U.S. assistance that is being provided to the country for years to reach to the soldiers on the ground. So, all these factors together, any cut in any assistance for Afghan security forces will really impact their ability to counter the threat that the country currently is facing.
Ayaz Ghul spoke to me from Islamabad. The attack comes as Afghan faces a myriad of crises, including a raging insurgency, political deadlock, a massive cut in U.S. aid, and a failing peace process among the rising coronavirus threat. It was not too long ago the Afghan Taliban trumpeted the defeat of the Islamic State militant group in Afghanistan's Kunar province, but U.S. officials remain wary, though they concede the terror group's grip on the territory and rural areas appear to be slipping. Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent, and I spoke to him via Microsoft Teams about the latest assessment.
It's an interesting contrast in terms of the assessments right now. On the one hand, U.S. intelligence and military officials say Islamic State Khorasan, the Islamic State affiliate in Afghanistan, has been squeezed tremendously over the past 6-7 months, both by the Taliban, which has run campaigns against them, essentially removing any land holdings they had in eastern Nangarhar province in Afghanistan, and then just recently announced that it had kicked Islamic State out of Afghanistan's Kunar province. In addition, the U.S. has continued to run operations against Islamic State, as has the Afghan government. So there's that squeeze. At the same time, intelligence officials have said for quite some time that they are extremely worried about IS Khorasan, Islamic State Khorasan, because of their global ambitions and some of the talent that they have that could possibly make that a reality, make worldwide attacks or global attacks a reality. But they've been losing ground and their presence isn't what it's been. So you have these two simultaneous assessments going on.
What else do we not know about the future of IS in that particular region that you can share with our listeners?
The thing to remember about Islamic State in Afghanistan is that it has been on the brink numerous times before. It has seen its leaders killed by U.S. airstrikes, by U.S. operations. It's seen its numbers dwindle from thousands, and right now they're thought to still have anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 fighters in Afghanistan, despite all the losses. So, but they've seen their number whittled from a high of around 5,000 to the low hundreds, maybe even dozens. And yet they always seem to be able to come back. They always seem to be able to play upon the political tensions in Afghanistan to increase their membership and become a significant force, not anything close to the Taliban, but still a force to be reckoned with. The other thing to remember is that even though the U.S. has seen Islamic State lose its grip on land and on territory, mostly in the rural areas, they still have a presence in Kabul and in other urban areas. And they say that combined with the fact that the terror organization on a worldwide level has in many ways gone to an insurgency model, they're still going to be dangerous and they're still a major concern.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Turkey has charged 20 suspects, including two former aides to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, over the 2018 murder of Riyadh critic Jamal Khashoggi. Prosecutors accused Saudi Arabia's deputy intelligence chief, Ahmed al-Asiri, and the royal court's media czar, Saud al-Qahtani, of leading the operation and giving orders to a Saudi hit team. Khashoggi, who wrote for the Washington Post, was killed after he entered the Saudi consulate in Turkey on October 2, 2018, to obtain paperwork for his wedding to his Turkish fiancée. Turkey carried out its own investigation into the murder after being unhappy with Saudi explanations. Music fans across the globe are mourning the death of a Cameroon-born saxophonist. Manu Dibango is considered one of the most influential musicians in world dance music. He died in France after contracting the coronavirus. VOA's Mariamo Diallo has this look back at the music legend.
86-year-old veteran Afro-jazz legend Manu Dibango died in Paris Tuesday after contracting the coronavirus. From his home in the Democratic Republic of Congo, fellow musician Koffi Olomide is shocked that Dibango is gone.
It's a huge loss. It happened at the moment we were confined. I myself am confined because it's the only way to fight this enemy.
Professor Andre Yoka Mudaba, director of the National Arts Institute in the DRC, says while Dibango is a lost musical treasure, he also had a force of personality.
Manu Dibango's symphonic laughter. He wouldn't say a sentence without bursting out laughing. He was a man at his age of an inalienable youth, unalterable and always positive.
In an interview last year, Dibango reflected on an exceptional career of more than 60 years.
I pinch myself in the morning and say to myself, I'm still alive. What am I up to today? The problem is, what's on my schedule? Not, hey? Yesterday was great. Nostalgia. This is great too. But above all, there's the fact that everyone has their own karma and way of doing things. It's the sum of many good and bad things because the two obviously go together.
A message on Dibango's official Facebook page says his funeral will be held in private, followed by a tribute when possible. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.